From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Paradoxically, it's the issues that we all agree on that have divided us. I'm Ben from Ben & Jerry's. I'm working for the true majority because it's finally a quick and easy way to reunite us into the most powerful force.
What is the true majority? Ben Cohen and others are driving a big pink pig across the country to take on the military-industrial complex. But first, are unions a threat to national security? Government unions mobilize against Bush's attempts to bust unions in the new Department of Homeland Security. And troops for trade? The Bush administration threatens to bring in soldiers to squash possible longshoremen strike. Federal mediators are intervening in a Boeing strike vote. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This news from Afghanistan. A car bomb exploded in the heart of Kabul today. Police say the blast killed 22 and injured dozens more. The blast, which occurred at the market near the Ministries of Information and Education, was the most serious in a string of bombings that Afghan officials say are aimed at destabilizing Afghanistan's fragile government. President Bush is saying he will seek congressional approval before attacking Iraq. It's not clear precisely how much consultation will take place. He told lawmakers, quote, "At an appropriate time and after consultations with the leadership, I will seek congressional support for U.S. action to do whatever is necessary to deal with the threat posed by Saddam Hussein's regime." Bush told reporters after the congressional meeting he made very clear to members that doing nothing is not an option. The Washington Post is reporting that as lawmakers left the cabinet room, several said they're convinced the nation is headed toward war with Iraq. Bush plans to meet with British Prime Minister Tony Blair this weekend at Camp David. On September 12th, he's scheduled to address the United Nations in New York, where he's expected to seek a UN Security Council resolution that will set a deadline for Iraq to open its weapon sites to unrestrained inspections and to apply punitive action if Saddam Hussein refuses. Also, yesterday, House Speaker Dennis Hastert announced Congress will vote on Iraq before the November 5th election, ensuring that Iraq will be a high-profile issue in the campaign for control of the House and Senate. Meanwhile, the military has begun a third commercial shipment of weapons and tanks to the Middle East. Military analysts say the shipments mirror similar movements ahead of the 1991 Gulf War. CBS News is reporting the military began developing plans to attack Iraq on September 11th. Meeting notes acquired by the news agency show War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld ordered preparations to begin for an attack, even though there was no evidence showing Iraq was involved in the September 11th attack. Rumsfeld told his staff, "Go massive, sweep it all up, things related and not." All of this comes as a new ABC News poll shows public support for military action dropped from 69% to 56% in August alone. Less than 40% of Americans say they will support a military strike if the U.S. attacks without support from allies. And this news in New York from the New York Daily News. One of the most savage entries in New York's crime annals, the 1989 Central Park wilding attack on a female jogger, may have to be rewritten after DNA testing now clearly points to a new suspect. New DNA analysis has confirmed that genetic evidence taken from the victim belongs to a convicted rapist and murderer who first admitted to the attack in January. What's more, key pieces of physical evidence that swayed juries in two racially charged trials to convict five teens are being discredited through DNA tests. New testing was done with forensic technology not available when the case was tried. Law enforcement sources said these tests show hair found on one youth is not from the victim, as prosecutors had said. They also say blood believed to be from the jogger found on a stone allegedly used in the attack is not hers. Other physical evidence introduced at the trials included grass and dirt-stained clothing that prosecutors said came from the scene. The viciousness of the April 19, 1989 attack, in which the jogger, a white investment banker, then 28, was brutally beaten, sexually assaulted, and left for dead, stunned New Yorkers and flamed racial tensions. The black and Hispanic youths ranging in age from 14 to 17 were initially among some 30 teens who were picked up after rampaging through Central Park that night. At that time, Donald Trump took out a full-page ad in newspapers calling the group a wolf pack and calling for the death penalty. The Australian government has accused Brisbane Mayor Jim Sorley of trivializing the Iraqi issue and an anti-war website that lampoons President George Bush as a gung-ho sheriff happy to take Australian lives. Sorley launched the website yesterday with images of President Bush interposed with pictures of chimpanzees. The site attacks the self-anointed leader of the free world for running roughshod over international law and morality and slams the Australian government for its blind support of the U.S. When an Australian reporter asked Sorley if the website defamed the president, he said he hoped Bush sues. He said George Bush defames himself every time he opens his mouth. He does not need my webpage. Sorley's website can be found at sites.ourbrisbane.com/nowar. Colombian lawmakers, human rights defenders, and Colombia's Attorney General's office are urging the government to repeal a decision to allow war criminals to remain outside the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court for 7 years. It emerged publicly only on Sunday that former Colombian President Andrés Pastrana's administration secretly invoked a clause in the International Criminal Court Treaty, which allows a 7-year delay in implementation. According to human rights groups, 15 civilians are killed in Colombia's civil war every day, and massacres are common. Colombia's foreign ministry is also considering adopting a bilateral treaty proposed by Washington, under which U.S. troops and advisors in Colombia who commit crimes against humanity could not be tried by the International Criminal Court. Meanwhile, the U.S. has launched its biggest and most aggressive round of aerial spraying in Colombia's coca-growing heartland, with Colombian President Uribe's full support. In the last onslaught, U.S. and Colombian officials pledged small farmers would be spared. But small farmers were sprayed, and the operation ended prematurely when former President Andrés Pastrana forbade some missions for fear of further alienating peasants. Community leaders say the campaign impoverishes farmers and kills off their legal crops. Environmentalists say the herbicide is dangerous to humans. The U.S. has spent $1.7 billion in the last 3 years in Colombia, but in the year 2000, the amount of coca is estimated to have increased by 25%. The U.S. State Department's launching a 2-day conference exploring anti-Americanism today in Washington. Government officials hope the conference will help them learn ways to improve the image of the U.S. overseas. The talks are closed to the public, and the government has refused to publicly release the names of the speakers at the gathering. 20 leading academics from the U.S. and around the world are expected to address the conference. In related news, the New York Times is reporting Hollywood's first public service commercial promoting peace and tolerance and aimed at television audiences in the Arab world will be released today. The ad features former Moroccan Olympic hurdler discussing the importance of tolerance. The Hollywood 911 International Messaging Group had originally planned to use Muhammad Ali for its first commercial, but the Sony Pictures claims the former boxing champion had a scheduling conflict. Johns Hopkins University professor Fuad Ajami told the New York Times he thinks the ad will be dismissed as U.S. propaganda. The Hollywood group began its work after meeting with presidential advisor Karl Rove last November.
The workers on the SB line for strikes are not a call, but Casey Jones, the engineer, he wouldn't strike at all. His boiler, it was leaking, and the driver's on the bum, and the engines and the bear, and they were all out of plumb.
Casey Jones
kept his junk pile running.
Casey Jones
was working double time.
Casey Jones
got a wooden medal for being good and faithful on the SB line. The worker said to Casey, won't you help us win this strike? But Casey said, let me alone, you'd better take a hike. Well, Casey's wheezy engine ran right off the wheezy track, and Casey hit the river with an awful smack.
Casey Jones
hit the river bottom.
Casey Jones
broke his bloomin' spine.
Casey Jones
turned into an angel. He got a trip to heaven on the SP line. When Casey got to heaven, way up to that pearly gate, he said, I'm Casey Jones, the guy that pulled the SP freight. You're just the man, said Peter, our musicians are on strike. You can get a job of scabbing anytime you like.
Casey Jones
got a job in heaven.
Casey Jones
was doing mighty fine.
Casey Jones, the Union Scab by Pete Seeger, here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Hi, Juan.
And good day to our listeners around the country. And this a stunning announcement or a report yesterday in the Daily News in my newspaper about the Central Park jogger case, perhaps one of the most contentious and cases that divided New York City along racial lines. Now apparently a huge possibility that the entire case has been thrown out as a result of this DNA evidence, and that we could be facing a modern day version of the Scottsboro Boys right here in New York, now finally being uncovered.
And we will be taking on this case tomorrow, the evidence, the person who has now confessed, and what is happening to the young men who served so many years in jail. Right now, though, we go to Washington. The Senate launched a contentious debate on Tuesday over President Bush's plans for a Homeland Security Department. Democrats flatly rejected White House demands for the power to waive labor protection laws for its estimated 170,000 workers, with Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle calling Bush's proposal, quote, a power grab of unprecedented magnitude that would undermine the government's civil service system.
The director of the White House Homeland Defense Office, Tom Ridge, also dug in his heels, claiming the new department needs broad powers to hire, fire, promote, or demote, and pay employees to meet emerging terrorist threats. He said union rights must be waived in matters of national security. The Senate crafted its own bill to create a Homeland Security bill before the Senate's August break. White House officials have threatened to veto the Senate bill because it does not give the president the power to undermine government unions. The White House also opposes a Senate provision that would make the Homeland Security advisors post a statutory office with Senate confirmation. Tom Ridge was not confirmed by the Senate.
We're joined now by representatives of a number of unions that held a news conference yesterday in Washington, D.C., with various senators from Hillary Clinton of New York to Barbara Boxer of California, Ted Kennedy in Massachusetts. Denise Dukes is with us. She is the president of FEMA Headquarters Union. That's the Federal Emergency Management Agency in Washington, D.C. T.J. Bonner, 24-year veteran Border Patrol agent and president of the National Border Patrol Council. Also joining us is Jackie Simon, director of public policy of the American Federation of Government Employees. We're also joined by a White House representative, associate counsel to the president, but we're going to begin with T.J. Bonner, president of the National Border Patrol Council. Can you talk about your concerns? What is being proposed?
Well, what they're proposing to do is eliminate civil service protections, collective bargaining rights for 50,000 employees who currently enjoy these rights and protections. And in our view, this would just push everybody towards the exit doors, everyone who's worth their salt. So what you would end up with is an agency staffed, by desperate people who are just looking for a job to tide them over until they can find the next job. That's not good public policy.
And the argument for not only eliminating union protections but civil service protections?
Their argument is that national security somehow is compromised by membership in a union. Don't ask me how. All of the people who rushed up the stairs of the World Trade Center were good union members. None of them hesitated at all. The people who are out there guarding your borders every day are good union members. Nothing stops them from doing their job. So you'll have to defer to the White House if you want to know what their take is.
Let's ask Brad Berenson, associate counsel to the White House. What is the argument of the president?
Well, it's very important to clarify with respect to this union issue that all the president is seeking for the new department is the exact status quo. He wants no change at all in existing law that currently applies to every single department and agency of government. It is just absolutely incorrect that he is seeking to eliminate or undermine public employee unions or in any way affect union rights in the new department. All his proposal would do is import existing law exactly as it stands now. And under existing law, employees have the right to organize and bargain collectively, and the president retains a residual authority where national security requires it to declare that certain parts of the government will not be subject to the federal labor management relations regime. That authority has been used sparingly and with restraint by every president since John F. Kennedy, whose idea it was, and it was enacted into positive law under President Jimmy Carter. This has never been controversial until today, and it's really the unions that have put the issue on the table by trying to secure for themselves special protections in the new department that would vary existing law.
T.J. Bonner, your response.
There's a reason that these, quote, special protections are necessary. Number one, we have a new department whose mission is national security. If you read the existing law, it says that employees who perform national security work, and that's not defined, will be exempted. So under the application of the existing law, all of these employees would automatically lose these rights and protections that they've enjoyed for 40 years. Also, it's important to note that President Bush used this authority in January of this year to exclude about 800 people, mostly clerical, in response to an organizing campaign down in South Florida by the National Treasury Employees Union. I would hardly call that judicious.
Application of existing law does not automatically exempt anyone in the new department. What it does is it creates presidential authority in the future to exempt people, but only if certain statutorily specified conditions are met. These people have to be involved in intelligence, counterintelligence, investigative, or national security work, and the president has to make a formal written finding in an executive order that application of the federal labor management relations regime would be incompatible with national security considerations. The January order was a very sound and judicious use of that power. It really had nothing to do with those clerical employees who unfortunately lost their membership in collective bargaining units. It was an order directed to larger units and agencies within the Department of Justice, and the president had no power to exclude from that order the folks who were already part of bargaining units at the clerical level.
Well, I'd like to bring into the conversation Jacques Simon, Director of Public Policy for the American Federation of Government Employees. Your response as well to the White House position that this is really not anything substantively different from the powers that already exist in matters of national security for the president.
Oh, thanks. My name's Jackie Simon.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jackie. Yes.
It's okay. I'd say two things. First of all, I don't think it clarifies anything to argue about the intent of the Bush administration with regard to collective bargaining rights and with regard to the civil service protections as if they were separate issues. They're sort of two sides of the same coin. And if you follow the debate, it's unmistakable that the Bush administration's position is that civil service protections and collective bargaining agreements are an impediment to Homeland Security. And I think that T.J. Bonner's comment spoke to that. It's not an indirect, but a very direct charge that a merit system, the employee's right to appeal firings, the procedures and rules for open competition for to win a federal a job, the determination of how much pay is accorded to any given federal job, all of those things have been described by the Bush administration and proponents of its legislation as some kind of roadblock that prevents the government's ability to protect our homeland. The collective bargaining rights is really just sort of symptomatic of this sort of outlook that says unless we have total unilateral control about who we hire and who we fire and how much we pay each individual, and unless we are able to take away any kind of right of the employee to blow the whistle on mismanagement, fraud, abuse, corruption, if we have any kind of restrictions on how we spend money in this new department, what kinds of contracts we let and to whom, any kind of accountability whatsoever will be hampered in our ability to protect the homeland. Consequently, we're going to be able to have a blank check, total power, and history has shown us again and again, when governments have that kind of total unilateral power with regard to the civil service, it becomes a political spoil system. Jobs are awarded on the basis of who you know, not what you know. Jobs are awarded on the basis of political affiliation. People get promotions and raises based on political favors, and they get demoted or fired if they're not willing to let the contract to the political crony, or if they're not willing to follow orders that sometimes are not in the public interest. And that's what we're trying to protect here.
Jackie Simon, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we're going to bring a FEMA union president into the conversation and also get response again from the White House. We're talking about what will happen and what will become the largest department of the U.S. government if it's approved by Congress, the Department of National Security. Are unions a threat to national security? You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
You said you've lost your job. That you thought was so secure. There was a game being played. But you did not know the score. Companies merged to make money. Because they all want to make more. Now they're cutting back the workforce. And your life is in an uproar.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. That was Downsizing by Colin Ska Johnson, a listener from New Jersey. Thanks, Colin. You are listening to Pacifica Radio, and we are talking about the debate that's going on in Congress right now around the Department of Homeland Security, and will it be approved? The issue of President Bush's plans, demands for the power to waive labor protection laws for the estimated 170,000 workers. We're joined on the telephone by Brad Berenson, who's an associate counsel to the president. Also joining us, T.J. Bonner, 24-year veteran of the Border Patrol, 24-year Border Patrol agent, president of the National Border Patrol Council, Jackie Simon, with us from the American Federation of Government Employees. Also with us is Denise Dukes, who is a management analyst at the Federal Emergency Management Agency. She's president of the FEMA Headquarters Union, Local 406. So your response to the plans and what you think of a Department of Homeland Security, Denise Dukes.
Based on the documents that we've been doing here at FEMA, one of the reasons why the unions were established at FEMA, because we had bad relationship with management back in the 1980s. And once we established the unions in the early 1990s, 1991, FEMA have had good rapport with union and management. And based on the good rapport that we've had with management, all our employees have always had bargaining rights. And we feel that we want to continue to keep the bargaining rights because the union here have actually went to management in good faith to keep any ULPs or any discrimination suits filed against the agency because of this. And we feel that if this is taken away from us, the employees won't have this opportunity to continue to establish a working rapport with their managers.
I'd like to ask Brad Berenson about this issue. Certainly an agency like FEMA, no one has accused it of the fact that having union members has hampered its ability or having worker protections have hampered its ability, and also local police departments. You will find across the nation, obviously, have been enlisted in work for Homeland Security, yet we find that most of them are unionized.
Absolutely. And the president has tremendous respect for federal workers, be they members of unions or not members of unions. He has terrific rapport all around the country with union members and with various unions, has gotten warm receptions throughout the country from those audiences. And he has made it very clear, he's told anyone who will listen, that not only does he not have any sort of anti-union or anti-worker agenda or animus, on the contrary, he feels a great kinship with these union members. This has nothing to do with the suggestion that unions in and of themselves or union members are somehow a threat to national security. What this really is about is giving the secretary of the new department, who is going to have an unprecedented management challenge on his hands, to bring in 22 different personnel systems, 7 different pay systems, and harmonize them and get them working together. He's got to have the power and flexibility to create a unified, sensible, fair system for the department. It is an absolute distortion to suggest that what the administration is seeking is some sort of a blank check, unilateral authority, unfettered discretion to hire, fire, pay as they will. The language that the administration supported in the House of Representatives guarantees federal workers' rights in all of the areas that Ms. Simon from AFGE cited. It guarantees the merit system. It guarantees anti-discrimination principles. It guarantees the full suite of federal employee benefits. Out of approximately 36 parts of Title V that govern the civil service system, the president is seeking flexibility in only 6 limited areas, with everything else guaranteed. And in those 6 areas, he doesn't have the power, which Congress incidentally granted to the head of TSA, to make changes unilaterally. These have to be changes made by regulation, promulgated jointly by the secretary and the head of the Office of Personnel Management, and the statute guarantees that unions and other worker representatives will have a seat at the table in the beginning of that process to help design these changes in this system.
Yes, go ahead, Jackie.
Okay.
Simon.
First of all, very interestingly, about 2 weeks ago, the organization that represents the senior executive service, which is the top tier of management in the federal government, wrote the president a letter offering to sort of bridge the gap between the position that the administration has taken and what they defined some in Congress as defending the status quo. But they warned that the position the administration was taking, which really is a blank check, was dangerous and troubling. What the legislation asks for is the authority to eliminate, as the representative of the administration said, several key aspects of the civil service system. And they have refused, absolutely refused, to say what they'll replace it with. They say that the existing civil service system is incompatible with the new agency's mission to protect Homeland Security. They need this sweeping authority to unilaterally eliminate all of those aspects of Title V, the 7 aspects the White House representative refers to, but they have not put on the table their alternative. They're just asking everyone to trust them. They're asking for anywhere from $13 to $15 billion per year, which is the personnel costs of an agency with 170,000 federal employees. Just give us the $15 billion, and we'll spend it well. Just trust us. We'll come up with a new system, just as good, better than the old one, but we're not going to tell you before you give us that authority what it's going to look like. Just trust us. And we don't trust them because of their behavior in the past, as T.J. Bonner described, the elimination, the capricious elimination of collective bargaining rights for 500 to 800 workers at the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Well, I'd like to ask Brad Berenson. An article in the Washington Times talks about how this bill would also exempt its employees from whistleblower protection, the very law that helped expose intelligence gathering failures before September 11th. Could you respond to that issue of a whistleblower protection?
I have not seen that article, but I would be very surprised if an informed author could write that, because the House language on personnel issues expressly guarantees, with the full support of the administration, whistleblower protections. That issue was always a red herring. The president never intended to vary the protections applicable to whistleblowers in the least, and when he was asked to agree in the House process to language explicitly reaffirming that all those protections would apply, he readily agreed.
I want to ask you a question,
another comment that has been made by the White House, and that was Ari Fleischer's comment using a hypothetical example of a drunken U.S. Border Patrol agent who lets a potential terrorist into the country. Fleischer said the new department would be able to fire that agent immediately. And I wanted to get the comment of T.J. Bonner, president of the National Border Patrol Council, on that, the issue of being able to fire people immediately.
Sure. We think that's a bad idea. There's a concept in our country called due process. Currently, under existing law, if someone were to show up drunk on duty, whether they allowed a terrorist into the country or not, they would be suspended immediately, their badge and gun would be taken away. So the public interest would be served. If they allowed a terrorist into the country, in other words, a national security issue, they could be suspended without pay immediately. If they just showed up drunk, they would be suspended with pay for 30 days while the agency conducted an investigation, allowed the employee to present his or her side of the story so that due process could be served. After that 30 days, the employee, of course, is free to appeal the ultimate decision of the agency, but without pay. The employee is on the outside looking in. What they're looking for is unfettered authority to just fire somebody, no due process whatsoever. And I'd like to tie this back into the whistleblower law, although that would still be on the books. If you can fire somebody for no reason whatsoever, without any meaningful appeal rights, you can fire them for whistleblowing. You can fire them because they're female. You can fire them because they're African American. You can fire them for any reason and say, oh, we did it because they're a poor performer.
Would this be a fair question to you, T.J. Bonner? There has been a serious crackdown on immigrants in this country since September 11th, and a lot of people have said they're really just the canary in the coal mine, and there's been particular criticism of what happens to immigrants when they try to come across the border. But the whole issue of what happens to immigrants, that idea of first they come for one group and no one speaks up, so they come for another group. That first the crackdown was on immigrants, and now it's on you. What is your response to that?
Well, I guess my first response is, how do we know it's just immigrants? Because there are a number of people who are still in jails who have never been charged with anything, don't have an attorney. Are we really sure that it's just immigrants? You know, you're exactly right. Who's next? Anybody who speaks out against the administration, then they get jailed with no charges, no right to an attorney. I think everybody should be very concerned about the direction that this administration is heading.
And Mr. Berenson of the White House, again, a final chance for your response in terms of this growing concern that on the part of many Americans, that in the effort of the administration to protect the nation, that we may be heading in the direction of doing away with a lot of the basic rights that Americans have felt are part of the definition of what sets this nation apart from many other nations in the world.
Well, I think the public understands the depth of the president's commitment to use every power at his disposal to try to protect us from further attacks. We face tremendous challenges in this area, and the president often repeats that he sees it as his primary duty to use the tools at his disposal to try to make us safer. That having been said, He's also committed to protecting civil liberties and has from the start. In the design of the Homeland Security Department, for example, the president was personally quite concerned to make sure that the new department would not become a locus of law enforcement, of domestic intelligence gathering, of things that might trench on people's civil liberties. Most commentators who've looked at what the administration has done in this area have concluded that by comparison to what has happened during time of war historically, the administration has been very, very measured and very, very careful in the way that it has dealt with these issues. The people who are being held on immigration charges are all people who have violated the immigration laws, at least are alleged to have violated the immigration laws, and they get the full measure of process available in the administrative review system and in the courts. There are only two individuals who are in the situation that Mr. Bonner referred to. They are being held as enemy combatants, that is, enemies of the United States in the war on terrorism, and they have both filed habeas corpus petitions, which are under review in the federal courts. The position we have been taking in these cases has been responsible and measured, and we hope strikes the right balance between security and protection for civil liberty, both of which are very important to President Bush.
Can I ask you about the very name, Homeland Security? There's an AP piece that's out today that sort of goes into it, and it talks about it being an uncommon word to begin with. Homeland became an everyday word after September 11th, institutionalized when President Bush created the Office of Homeland Security. And then it goes on to quote various linguists and sociologists. Jeff Nieberman, who teaches European history at Boise State University, says it's right out of Nazi Germany. The word German word Heimat means homeland and was used by the Nazis. Leslie Savan, who wrote a book about advertising and popular culture, said homeland makes her think not only of Germany, but also of Russia and South Africa's former apartheid government. She said it's been one of those words that's supposed to sound cozy and warm, but because it sounds cozy and warm, it's been used by totalitarian governments. What about your comment on President Bush coming up with this term, Homeland Security?
Well, I'm sure the Nazis also used the terms defense and state, but I don't think that makes the Department of Defense or the Department of State any sort of frightening totalitarian bureaucracy. The truth is that that was the term that had been in circulation at the time, immediately after 9/11. I think it was already in the literature. There had been numerous Blue Ribbon commissions that had studied the way we were configured and our government was set up to deal with homeland security concerns. And I'm not aware that there was any serious discussion or debate given to the term. The executive order, like so much else after 9/11, was prepared as speedily as possible, and I don't think anyone was detained by extensive discussions of the terminology. The linguistic debate may be interesting, but I don't think it really sheds much light on the substance.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. This is a debate that's going to go on. Our guests have been Brad Berenson, who's associate counsel to the president, as well as T.J. Bonner, 24-year veteran Border Patrol agent, president of the National Border Patrol Council, Jackie Simon, director of public policy, American Federation of Government Employees, and Denise Dukes, who is the president of FEMA Headquarters Union, Local 4060, joining us all from Washington, D.C. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to talk about the Bush administration saying that they would bring troops in to deal with the longshoremen if they struck, and possibly even Boeing workers if they struck. And then we'll be joined by Ben of Ben and Jury's to talk about the true majority, he calls it. Stay with us.
Egypt, I will fly. I go swimming in the big Egyptian river, bathing in the waters of the Nile. The sun is shining down and everybody's happy, bathing in the waters of the Nile. My job is so secure, and my government is stable. The weather's getting better, a little warmer every year. And now we've got free trade, and everyone will prosper. The locals here are happy, I think I'll have another beer. Let's go swimming now. We're swimming in the big Egyptian river, bathing in the waters of the Nile. The sun is shining down and everybody's happy.
Swimming in the big, Dana Lyons here on Democracy Now! Breaking the sound barrier. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Port employers and union leaders representing West Coast longshoremen returned to the negotiating table Wednesday, 3 days after a breakdown in contract talks sparked fears of a crippling labor slowdown. Employers say they'll lock out the workers in the event of a work slowdown, which would in turn force a strike. The Bush administration has threatened to bring in troops to quell a strike. The West Coast ports handle half the nation's trade, worth more than $300 billion annually. Economists say a work stoppage could cost the national economy $1 or $2 billion per day. September is the peak month for imports from Asia, including Christmas merchandise bound for the shelves of U.S. retailers.
Meanwhile, Boeing's three-year contract with its union expired on Monday. The company last week presented what it's calling its final offer, which included bonuses and raises, but it also angered the union because it contained rising health care costs and smaller than desired pension increases. The company also refused to guarantee jobs or job growth with production boosts. Union members had begun voting to authorize a strike when federal mediators intervened and urged both sides to come to Washington. The director of the Federal Mediation Coalition Services, Peter Hertgen, wrote to Boeing and union officials saying he had determined that any job action threatens to cause a substantial disruption of commerce.
So Boeing officials have met voluntarily with the mediators, but committed only to explaining the contract proposal, not to reopening talks after 3 months of negotiations. Negotiators for the International Association of Machinists, which represent 25,000 Boeing workers, are set to meet with the federal mediators today. We're joined on the phone by Professor Harley Shaken. He specializes in labor in a global economy at the University of California, Berkeley. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Well, it's nice to be here.
It's good to have you with us. Well, what about this idea of troops for trade? What about the Bush administration saying they would bring in troops to deal with any kind of strike of the longshoremen or Boeing? Is this unusual?
It's very unusual and the worst possible precedent. The very threat of doing it undermines the collective bargaining process because it gives one side, in this case the employer, the notion of all they have to do is hang tough, and the administration will intervene in a very dramatic way that could harm or even bust the union entirely.
When is the last time that troops were used by the federal government in a labor dispute?
It's been a very long time. The last time the Taft-Hartley law was applied, which allows the president to order work to resume for 80 days, was under the Carter administration in 1978 in a coal mining strike. So the notion of using troops is something that happens during wartime or in the most severe kinds of national emergencies. But we would have to go back an awfully long time, even for the threat of using troops, let alone their actual deployment.
And in terms of, you say the potential, clearly the support for employers that this presents, what's been the reaction of union leaders to the threats?
There's been very, very strong reaction, not surprisingly. And there's been a broader reaction that is a little more surprising from many political figures, particularly on the West Coast, who are basically saying in no uncertain terms that the administration should allow collective bargaining to take its course. Because the dual issue here isn't just the precedent of using troops or even invoking Taft-Hartley, but also of undermining the whole collective bargaining process itself. So you've gotten many state legislators, members of Congress, senators, who are essentially telling the administration, I'll let the parties bargain.
Explain Taft-Hartley.
Taft-Hartley gives the president, in this particular provision of Taft-Hartley, gives the president the ability to declare a national emergency, thereby sending everyone back to work for an 80-day cooling-off period. After that period is over, then there's a number of other options, including going to the Congress and getting legislation that would bring people back to work.
So do you see this as a part of the general thrust of the Bush administration to, in essence, put the country in a state of perpetual war and claim again national security or homeland security as a reason for what is essentially a lot of political moves?
I think that's one of the important dimensions of what's taking place. I think, unfortunately, the administration is using homeland security as a wedge to accomplish a whole range of social objectives that it really wouldn't be able to approach under any other circumstances. We're seeing that with the Department of Homeland Security. We're seeing that in the context of the longshore strike, where administration spokespeople have essentially said, look, we're at war. How can we talk about a strike? So we're seeing that in any number of labor issues where the administration, both symbolically and substantively, is moving in a very anti-union direction and using the issue of homeland security essentially to quiet any debate or to gain its objectives.
Well, Harley Shank, I want to thank you very much for being with us, a professor at University of California, Berkeley. He specializes in labor and the global economy. As the Bush administration cracks down on unions in the name of the so-called war on terrorism, a well-known business leader has taken to the streets. Yesterday, he was driving a large pink pig through the streets of New York to protest military spending. Did you need a special license for this pig?
No, actually, it is deliberately designed to be roadworthy and legal.
Well, that's Ben Cohen. He's the co-founder of Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Great to be here.
So why the pig?
Well, actually, it's three pigs. There are three piggy banks, and the huge one is the Pentagon budget. Then there's a little one that's the education budget, and then there's a little pig that's the humanitarian foreign aid budget. So we're concerned about national budget priorities, and it's a very graphic demonstration of them.
And the big pig has been getting fatter of late.
Boy, I'll say. The big pig is up to $400 billion. I mean, over $1 billion a day. It's more than we were spending during the Cold War. It's incredible that the so-called axis of evil that's spending, what, about $10 billion between the three of them have gotten the U.S. to spend as much money as the former Soviet Union, which used to be spending, $350 billion.
And these are an axis of evil that is still possibly developing nuclear weapons.
Exactly.
So you're founder and president of Business Leaders for Sensible Priorities, and you founded this new group, True Majority. What's the True Majority?
Well, the True Majority campaign brings together the people that are interested in the environment with people who are interested in children's issues or human rights or money in politics. Really what's happened is that there's this huge number of us. I mean, you look at Paul Ray's studies and over 50 million people, agree with us on these issues. And what happens is that there's about 10 different issues that we're all concerned about. And, it's impossible for one person to be active on all 10 issues, and it's impossible for one person to follow all those issues as they go through all the mishigash in Congress. And so we all concentrate on one or maybe two. But what happens is that ends up fragmenting us, and the True Majority brings us all together, because now with the use of the Internet and the prevalence of email, it is possible for this huge group of people that agree on this set of issues to essentially hire one agent in Congress that's monitoring Congress on all those issues. And at the precise moment when your voice counts, when you can be most effective, you get an e-alert, and then through the technology, with just one click, you end up sending a fax to your congressperson.
I've got a pair of binoculars here. What are they for?
They're for seeing the distant future of how great things could be if we institute some of these principles, which are really the basic American values of fairness, equality, compassion. And there's 10 specific principles in the True Majority campaign talking about everything from taking care of people in poverty at home and abroad to getting money out of politics to reducing our dependence on oil.
You come here at a time of the greatest corporate scandals in recent history. You are one of the founders of Ben & Jerry's. What about the issue of socially responsible business? Is it dead? I mean, you have Ben & Jerry's, which was taken over by this $40 billion company, Unilever. Nita Roddick is stepping down from the Body Shop. What about socially responsible business? Is it dead in this country?
Well, I think, first of all, there's, you know, Patagonia is still there, quite well, quite alive. Toms of Maine is growing. Stonyfield Farms is growing. And there's gobs of smaller companies that are going to be the big companies of tomorrow that are following the principles of socially responsible business. I think that there is a big problem that, you know, what has happened with Ben & Jerry's and the Body Shop and somewhat with Stonyfield Farms is that as these companies have gotten larger and, you know, us and the Body Shop were public, Stonyfield wasn't, but there's a need for investors to cash out, to get some kind of cash return on their investment. And I think that the problem is that the value for publicly held companies has come to be in terms of the price of the stock. And, you know, that's not the way it started out, and that's not the way it needs to be. You know, people can get a very good return just by sharing the profits, getting a dividend, and seeing their financial return as being in the form of a share of the profits each year, instead of seeing their financial return being in the form of a one-time windfall by selling the stock at a higher price.
And in terms of the whole issue of the normal view is that business being associated, or business leaders being associated with controversial politics, doesn't make for good business. And what's been your experience in terms of the impact on the business of your social activism?
Certainly, you know, that had been a concern at the beginning. You know, when Ben & Jerry's first came out with Peace Pops and took a stand in favor of reducing the Pentagon budget by 1%.
Explain what Peace Pops was about.
We came out with a chocolate-covered ice cream pop on a stick, and instead of using the packaging to talk about, you know, how great the pop is that you're about to eat, we used the packaging to talk about the issue of spending at least 1% of our defense budget on peace through understanding activities in order to reduce the root causes of war, as opposed to continuing to spend more money on weapons to fight the symptoms. So that was the stand that the company took. There was tremendous concern internally that, you know, this was going to be the death of the company and that right-wing groups were going to picket the supermarkets, et cetera. And none of that ever happened. And we got tremendous support from our customers for taking that stand. And I would say that it's what people had called, quote, controversial stands that really built Ben & Jerry's business, that because, you know, I mean, in terms of the man and woman on the street, these things aren't really controversial. You know, the huge majority of the population wants to be friends with people in other countries. The huge majority of the population does not want to be killing innocent people overseas.
So now that your face, you're in Ben and Jerry's face, are taken off the ice cream.
Well, if you look on the back, you know, and you look at the little circle, we're still there. You know, there's still a remnant. There's still a remnant of Ben and Jerry.
The true majority, one of the, I guess, deep problems right now in terms of American consciousness is that the American people have one view of the world, and the rest of the world has a completely different view of the world. And we see it, for instance, in today's New York Times, Chancellor Schroeder talking about that there's no way that Germany is going to go along with this this threatened war against Iraq. We have, you say, a true majority developing, but is its view of what's happening in the world really in accord with what the consciousness is in the third world, in the developing world, or even in Europe these days?
Well, it's certainly not exactly where the rest of the world is. I mean, you know, we are subject in the U.S. to a tremendous barrage of propaganda, and you know, the so we constantly get the news from the point of view of the government, and so that's the information that people in the U.S. have to go on to make their decisions.
Despite all this privately owned media.
Despite all this corporately owned media. You know, but I mean, if there are a lot of points of agreement. I mean, people in the U.S. overwhelmingly, time and time again, by overwhelming margins, demonstrate that they do not want the U.S. to act unilaterally. They want the U.S. to cooperate with the other nations of the world. And, I mean, even in this so-called, imminent or war with Iraq that I really feel that we can stop, you know, just about half the population, I mean, is already saying that they're against it. And that's even considering that they're getting all the propaganda and not hearing the other side of the story. I mean, I just can't believe that, you know, I mean, the U.S. is being such a hypocrite, being the holder of the largest arsenal of weapons of mass destruction, and saying that, you know, any other country that gets them is evil, and we have to invade them.
We only have a minute, but Ben Cohen, you're also involved with X Sweat. Can you talk about
SweatX?
Can you talk about what that is?
That is a sweatshop-free clothing manufacturer located in Los Angeles. It's the first union-owned cutting and sewing factory there, and it produces sweatshirts and T-shirts, paying people a livable wage, full benefits, health care, insurance, holidays, and employee ownership.
Well, I want to thank you very much for stopping by. If people want to get more information...
TrueMajority.com. 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 .com. TrueMajority.
And this puts you on an email list to get alerts on what's going on in Congress?
Yeah. And the key about it, what's different about it, is that you're joining together with people that are interested in the environment, with people that are interested in kids' issues, with people that are interested in money and politics, human rights. So it becomes a force that is as powerful as the Christian Coalition or the NRA.
And if they're interested in getting some of the clothing from SweatX,
where do they go? I forgot. There is a website, but I forgot.
Well, we'll put it on our website at democracynow.org. Ben Cohen, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
That does it for the program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Alex Wolf, and Mike DiFilippo is sitting in for Anthony Sloan as our music maestro and engineer. You can go to our website at democracynow.org. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!